Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, this week I got back to everyday living after a whirlwind couple of weeks. April, full stop, was a roller coaster ride. And just like the actual roller coaster at a theme park, there are moments I loved and others where I literally clung on for dear life screaming. But overall, it was a fun experience. This week was about doing much less, catching up at the laptop, tidying up the various piles of stuff that I'd accumulated in areas, and returning to the normal routine of the gym, things like that. And you know what? I really needed it. There were so many things rattling around in my head on the to-do list that it was so good to get them out of my head, down onto paper, and start working through them. I do love a good list. And I've decided to keep my ramblings quite short this week because I have two very brilliant brains to interview, and I really want to give it most of the time. But I want to highlight that I nearly got caught in an online scam this week. I saw a Facebook post go up of lots of household items. There was a fridge, freezer, a couch, a bunk bed, a TV. And as you know, we're moving towards our new home, and there was loads of bits that we would need for a really low price. And I started to create this story in my head about this woman in the picture that she must be moving back to another country and looking for a quick sale. So we started talking online. She gave me the address where she lived, said I could come down and see the stuff, but could I send money on Revolut to hold the stuff first? Now, I have sold stuff online before and you get so many time wasters. But I had a few red flags. I mean, I did think maybe that's why she wants the security of a deposit, because you get people asking you questions and then not showing up. But the red flags were she didn't have very many photographs on her Facebook page. And the photos of the stuff, weirdly enough, didn't look like they all came from the same house. And the name on the Revolut didn't quite match the Facebook name. It all seems really obvious when I lay it out like that. But I mean, I suppose the biggest red flag is that the offers seem too good to be true. So, you know, that usually, if it seems too good to be true, it isn't. But the main thing was the strong gut feeling I had that something was off. And that's why I wanted to mention it. I just kept thinking to myself, this isn't right. This isn't right. And I don't want to get too existential on the whole thing. But, you know, just this little voice that pops up and says, no, Claire. So I didn't send the money. I blocked the account and I just Googled the name to see if she had another social media account where I could see more photos and a sign of a real person. And a comment came up from another group page to say, beware of this name. It was a scam. So a warning of sorts and a reminder to always go with your gut feeling. Mine has rarely steered me wrong. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, a recent EU report has declared a global brain health emergency. While one in four over 80 have dementia or pre-dementia, memory decline is happening for many in their 30s. One in four adults are on antidepressants, sleeping pills or tranquilizers. What's going wrong and how do we recover? After 45 years of research, Patrick Holford, founder of the charitable foundation foodforthebrain.org and author of Upgrade Your Brain, is coming to Ireland to share what he's learned, and he joins me on the line now. Well, Patrick, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a bit about the 430,000 people over the past decade that you have been researching and what you found in relation to brain health.
Well, it starts with a pretty good story. I was working with Professor David Smith, who was the second in charge at Oxford Medical School. And it was actually his group that found out what Alzheimer's was and developed the brain scan that is used throughout the world. And they found a toxic protein called homocysteine in the brains of people with Alzheimer's, which occurs when you're lacking B vitamins. So they designed an absolutely perfect gold standard trial back in 2010, B vitamins or placebo. And they got a staggering up to 73% less rate of brain shrinkage on the vitamins versus the placebo. And I want to say that that is really, really staggering, because this disease, dementia, Alzheimer's, and so on, is shrinking brain. That's what it is. The latest drug, for example, got 20% increased brain shrinkage. So I said to him, what next? And he said, I hope within 5 years it'll be standard NHS policy. I said, what would the policy be? He said, you have to test a person's cognitive function from the age of 50 because you can pick up these subtle changes. Now, I didn't believe it would happen, and it hasn't. So at our charity, we got permission to digitize the very test that is used in memory clinics that measures your cognitive function. It's not a questionnaire. It's an interactive test. And we have, over the last 10 years, tested 430,000 people, about 100 a day. And in fact, last night with my professor, Tommy Wood, who runs our research, we found something that nobody knows. I mean, literally, it's quite extraordinary, because we looked at all this data and people's cognitive function is actually falling with every year from the age of 18. So what we have found is that someone at the age of 25 has less cognitive function than a 20-year-old, and at 40, less than a 35-year-old. And for women, it's particularly interesting because there's quite a drop-off in the menopause years. You know, things go downhill. So our whole charity has been about, what is it that protects your cognitive function, and what is it? And this is a really important point that stops you getting Alzheimer's, because most people do not realize that less than 1 in 100 cases of Alzheimer's is caused by genes. It's largely caused by what we eat and how we live.
Yeah, and I took your cognitive function test online last night, and even the length and breadth of the test itself, from, as you say, interactive questioning to how you live your life, just shows how holistic we need to be looking at our health. So it's not just our ability to use our working memory, but it's also how happy are we in our work? How satisfied are we in our life? How connected are we to others?
And how did you do on your dementia risk index? Did you have any, because there are 8 domains, like brain fats, active body, active mind. You can be red, you can be orange, you can be yellow, you can be green. How was it for you?
I got 72.81. So that seemed to be quite good, that I was above the norm for my age. So I'm not showing the early cognitive function problems.
So your cognitive function is good. And then on the questionnaire that follows it, it shows you your weak areas. How did you do there?
I must look into that now a bit better, because I did get the email with all the breakdown on that. And what I didn't know was, of the supplements I take, I didn't know the amount of each.
Yes.
So I think that could have impacted on it a little bit. And obviously, you know, with my job and my work, I am very conscious of how I live and how I eat and moving my body and all of that.
Well, we had a man in December, and what happened was his wife kept finding him in different rooms at night because he couldn't find the loo in his own house. And this led to a diagnosis of mixed dementia, Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. And his name is Alan, her name is Dorothy, and they said, well, what can we do? And the answer was nothing. And so they went online and they found foodforthebrain.org. They did the test. And, you know, bless her, because she really got on it with her husband. I mean, he couldn't talk, you know, and eat. He couldn't really conceive of tomorrow. He was a gardener. He couldn't plant his garden out. He was a computer programmer. He struggled to even turn his computer on or off. And they did everything. He went to bed an hour earlier. Sleep is important. It's how the brain recovers. He quit the sugar and started to eat less carbohydrates. He started supplementing the B vitamins that lower that homocysteine that I mentioned at the beginning, plus omega-3 fish oils, eating more fish, got active. Now he's joined a Morris dancing group. They go foraging, and his dementia risk index score has reduced massively, and his cognitive function score, because you were in the green, you're in the healthy zone. He was right down, you know, below 20, which is really the dementia zone. And that has improved. And he's back on the computer and he's planted his whole spring garden. Now, I don't want to give the wrong impression here that you can cure or reverse advanced Alzheimer's. You can't. But we are seeing people, even quite late in the process, who have some significant improvements that really change the quality of their life.
Well, my dementia risk index score is 34.7.
Fantastic. And that's low. That's good.
Okay. Well, because it says we want to move you closer to 0%.
Zero.
I mean, is 0% achievable?
Well, it is, because every single question that we score you on is something that you can change. So we may ask you about head injury, but you can't change it. You know, they're the genes. We can't change them. So every single question that you have answered is something that you can change: more exercise, more active mind, and so on. But the honest truth is that, you know, now that we've got data on nearly 500,000 people, we can, you know, I'd love to have this conversation in about 3 years, because from this, and recently, we've just introduced a pinprick blood test on a home test kit where you can actually measure the homocysteine for the B vitamins, the omega-3, the vitamin D, and so on. And with all this data, we're going to be the largest biobank. It's called the Cognition Biobank. And we can start to absolutely find out what is that perfect combination of diet, lifestyle, behaviors that protects you. And I think it's really important that people get that most people don't get Alzheimer's and dementia. One of my, I have a team of amazing experts. The Daily Mail just launched our campaign. We have Alzheimer's Prevention Day coming up on May the 15th, and I've got 16 professors from around the world. One of them is this lovely man, Professor Michael Crawford. He's just about to turn 94, and he has worked out something that no one has ever been able to explain satisfactorily, which is how we actually see, how the light that enters our eye turns precisely into that image that we see in front of us in color. And he's worked it out, and it's quantum physics. And his mind is as sharp as a razor, and he's 94. And my first teacher, I'm originally a psychologist and nutritionist, and my first teacher was I came across this research back in the 60s that had given B vitamins to people with schizophrenia in high doses and had an amazing result. And I jumped on a plane. I was studying schizophrenia at the time and met this lovely man who was the head of psychiatric research in Canada. And I said to him, how many people have you treated with this sort of mega vitamin approach? And he said, about 3,000. And I said, what's your success rate? And he said, 80% cure. And I said, I've never seen a cured schizophrenic. You know, please define cure. And he said, free of symptoms, able to socialize with family and friends and paying income tax. And that I had never seen a schizophrenic paying income tax. And that's actually how I got into this area. Now, he died also in his mid-90s. He stopped seeing patients 2 weeks before his death. 4 days before his death, he said he didn't feel too good. And 2 days before, he checked into the hospital. And he died free of drugs, without pain, with 2 weeks off work. So the point is, and I think this really illustrates it, the average woman in the EU right now is going to spend 14 years of their life unable to climb 10 steps. And you go, oh my God, that's a shocker. I need to keep strong. I need to, you know, exercise when I'm older. I need to keep my muscles, my leg muscles strong. And we see those people in Japan and Okinawa doing Tai Chi in their hundreds and so on. So we don't think that disability is an inevitable consequence if you do the right thing. And it's exactly the same with the brain. You are the architect of your own brain's destiny. It's as simple as that. And we do not need to be slipping into some level of dementia in our 80s or 90s. It's not normal. Alzheimer's is actually a disease. It's a very specific disease of a part of the brain. And what we've learned, and when I say we, I mean, you know, all these fantastic professors that I work with, is that there's a sort of perfect storm that is to do with sugar. And it's to do with a lack of omega-3s and seafood and a lack of B vitamins. Many older people malabsorb vitamin B12. So they just need to supplement it, because it's not that the diet is bad, it's just that they don't absorb it. And that, together with retiring, you know, is bad. I've just turned 66, and I'm proud to say I've just got my paraglider pilot license. So I've been studying meteorology and aerodynamics. So learning new things at every age is so important. So you've got to keep your mind active, your social life good. And then also what an animal does when you take your dog for a walk is they sleep. So sleep is how the brain recovers. And when you start to put all these things together, which is the purpose of my book, Upgrade Your Brain, and it's the reason why I'm traveling around Ireland from next week, Sligo, Galway, Dublin, Ennis, Tralee, Bantry, and Cork, is I'm going to teach people in this 2-hour seminar, there's a break in the middle, exactly how to protect your brain health. And it's not just to dementia-proof your diet and lifestyle. It's also for depression, anxiety, insomnia, stress, and this terrible situation we have with children. We have so much ADHD and autism. I mean, literally, the numbers have doubled in the last 10 years. The genes haven't changed, but we've got more and more kids with problems. The SEN, special needs schools, are overflowing. And what pains me is they're all sort of grouped together into this thing that we call neurodivergent. Like, I mean, obviously, we're all different and unique, which is to be, you know, respected and honored. But the idea that what we're seeing in front of us is normal when children can't concentrate, you know, the level of social withdrawal and aggression and inability to concentrate and so on. I mean, suicide rate has just gone up massively. I don't know the figures in Ireland, but in the UK last year, 1 million children were prescribed antidepressants. And if this situation continues, it's really going to be catastrophic. And you didn't mention one thing that happened 3 weeks ago, a massive global study in The Lancet Neurology, a very, very big study. And what it showed was that 43% of the world's population have disability to do with a brain or neurological condition from autism to Alzheimer's. 43%, 3.4 billion people. And the fact that this is occurring, you know, very, very broadly, you know, suggests that there's something fundamentally wrong, if you like, with the way we live in the modern world that is not brain friendly. And that's what my book, that's what the seminars, that's what Alzheimer's Prevention Day is all about. We have a very cool website called alzheimerspreventionprevention.info, which has a 30-question questionnaire. So I know what you did was very comprehensive, and you know, you've got to sit down, take the time, not get interrupted and so on. And that's really the best thing to do. But for people who just want to dip in, we've made this Alzheimer's prevention check. It's only 30 questions. It's under 3 minutes. And instantly it shows you the areas where you need to be, you know, paying some attention.
And people will argue about the increase in diagnosis that you're talking about, that we always had these issues ongoing, but people weren't reaching out or seeking help rather than there being an issue with modern life.
It's a little bit of both. I mean, there's no question, for example, as more children get diagnosed with autism, there are more parents who go, do you know, I have, you know, many of those, you know, very common traits I didn't realize. So there's no question that there is an increased diagnosis as a function of increased awareness. No question about that. However, it does not explain the magnitude of what is occurring. And it's not just occurring in Ireland and England. It's, you know, it's occurring all over the world. And to make something very, very concrete, we have to ask the fundamental question, which is how on earth did we become Homo sapiens? The point being that about 6 million years ago, we seemed to split from the chimpanzees and gorillas. Their brain size has stayed the same at about 350 cc or grams. Our brain size grew and grew and grew until about 20, 30,000 years ago. We have a brain size of 1,700 grams. And it's done on cranial size, literally the size of the skull. Now, today, our brain size is 1,330 grams. So it took us 6 million years to get to big-brained Homo sapiens, and it's taken us, we don't exactly know when this has occurred, but it's taken us 20,000 years to lose 20% of brain mass. And IQ has been falling about 7% a generation since the 60s or 70s. So you can't just say it's diagnosis. It's all around us. All the mental health problems are increasing. The diagnoses are increasing. The SEN schools are, you know, are flooded. And brain size is shrinking and IQ is falling. And in fact, every single, and there have been five commissioned studies now to look at the cost of mental health. And it just goes up and up. And right now, you know, brain disorders, mental health, cost more than all of cancer and heart disease and some on top of that. But there's really no policy for it. And what we're seeing, you know, with the 400,000 people, is that when people make changes, their cognitive function improves, their mood improves, their sleep improves, and so on. So you know, we've got so many good studies on omega-3 and B vitamins and sugar and all the rest of it. And it's just stepping back and understanding that the brain, like every part of your body, is fundamentally dependent on having the right building materials. I mean, there are so many children who never eat fish.
Yeah, you
know,
or supplement.
We used to have fish on Friday. You know, we used to have fish on Friday. At least you get a serving of fish a week.
Or be spooned cod liver oil. And I love that you are talking about giving people back control, which I think people often balk at a little bit, that we sort of say, well, lifestyle medicine, you know, against conventional medicine, whereas the two are complementary. But our crisis model of waiting until something goes wrong to seek help is surely not the best option. It's a fascinating topic. Your book is called Upgrade Your Brain. The Irish tour begins May 7th in Sligo, on to Galway May 8th, Dublin May 9th, and on around the country. If you want to find out more, you can go to patrickhulford.com/events, where you can get more information and buy tickets. And you can also go to foodforthebrain.org and perhaps take that test for yourself. Patrick Hulford, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you, Sláinte.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Fiona Nulon is an author, a columnist, a broadcaster, focusing primarily on physical and mental health and well-being, with a background in outreach therapy and social and therapeutic horticulture. He also lectures and holds workshops on nature-based therapies and is known as the Holistic Gardener. His latest book is called 52 Proverbs to Fight Depression and Trauma, featuring Irish holistic wisdom. And Fiona joins me in studio now. Well, Fiona, you're very welcome. Welcome back.
Hey, Claire. Thank you very much.
It's been a while since I've been in your company. You did come the last time to talk about your work as a herbalist and certain ailments. So this is a different type of book from
it
you.
Is. Yeah. Now, there's a connection, because the social and therapeutic horticulture, I mean, before it was known as social and therapeutic, it was horticultural therapy. And that was really dealing with people with kind of physical and intellectual disabilities, and really about the physicality of the garden, achievement rewards, getting out, sowing seeds, bringing them on. There's a lot of occupational therapy. Some of the kind of the movements that you do in gardening is really good for improving your pinch force, or working on muscles that you might have to do in occupational therapy. So it's really beneficial for the physical side. But then all of a sudden we started to notice that lots of people who were coming to avail of the services were coming with anxiety and depression, ADD, ADHD, you know, that there seemed to be a more psychological aspect to it. And for me, at that point, I went back and I trained in kind of cognitive behavioral therapy and stress reduction, mindfulness, all that sort of stuff, to be able to deal better, rather than using the garden as a tool to physically improve a complication. It was using all of the other stuff around the garden. Now, again, coming from the holistic side of stuff, that's something as simple as like a day, you know, to get out into the sunshine and you build up your vitamin D and you feel better about yourself. And that's, you know,
yeah, more and to watch something and grow and to talk shoulder to shoulder.
Which is all right. But the social side of it kind of speaks very much to what's been going on in recent years, where the more connected we seem to be getting on social media, the more disconnected we seem to be actually getting from one another. That's very, very difficult for people to make eye contact, or, you know, if they're standing on a bus queue and you say, did I just miss the X12, you know, they're kind of, well,
they've got the headphones in.
Yeah, you know, you have a phone in your pocket, look at it, and it's like, well, what's wrong with a bit of banter? And then later on you're thinking, God, I'm a bit lonely. How many opportunities did you miss in the day to have a little conversation or crack a joke or, you know?
Yeah, well, I never miss an opportunity. I'm an absolute oversharer in any queue or any bus stop going. So I'm breaking down the barriers constantly. I mentioned the title of the book in the intro, 52 Proverbs to Fight Depression and Trauma. Mm. And it's almost a risky title. And in the first page, there's a disclaimer, like, this is not to replace medical advice. Yeah. This is, as your name suggests, holistic.
Yeah.
And there's still great power in this, that two entities can work in tandem with each other.
And that's the thing, because, you know, I don't believe in, you should drop your meds and just all of a sudden take up something that's a spiritual practice and think that that's going to solve it for you. Maybe you need to stick with your meds while you're going on the spiritual journey to get to the point where you've kind of, you've healed yourself. So this is the thing with trauma. So, you know, within depression, I mean, you can have a minor disappointment, and if you work hard enough, you can turn it into a major depression, or you can have a chemical imbalance, you know? So that thing of like, we all go through stuff, and I hear this all of the time about like the up and coming generation. The up and coming generation, I mean, we're talking about the up and coming generation losing characteristics or being weaker probably since the wheel was invented. Do you know that, you know,
yeah,
you know, people like
the generation before
now,
always had it
always
tougher.
Has it. You know, the difference now is that there is more FOMO, you know, there is more anxiety about your social status. There is more having your headphones on or looking at your phone or scrolling. You know, people are more interested in doing their own podcast maybe than reading a book or educating themselves on something else. So there are points built into the modern society that can make us prone to overdwell, to ruminate, to get more anxious. These are all of the little triggers to depression. And in the book, what I'm trying to do was unbreak those triggers. But also a lot of depression comes from intergenerational trauma. You know, now this can go back as far as say even just take like the famine, you know, the fact that, you know, we had to lose our language, we had to lose some of our culture. And this is part of using the Proverbs to bring a bit of culture back and to have that grounding and connection. But like, even as a medicinal botanist, the amount of herbs that we lost the knowledge on because we swapped the language over and having to adapt to all of that. And you know, the trauma and the stress of that may have led to alcoholism. So we have a couple of generations of alcoholism. It makes it easier to develop an addictive personality within the nation or the community or the society, which makes it easier then for people to gamble a lot more or to take drugs. Or again, like that, you know, to get addicted to behavior, to behavioral traits, you know, often to jump on the bandwagon of stuff. So, you know, it's very easy for people to slip into that side of stuff. And then you find that their everyday reality is creating a view of the world that can be negative, that can be bad or sad, you know, or complicated. So it's how do we address all of these underlying conditions of why, you know, certain things within society get passed on? When do we stop passing it on? When can we draw a line under certain negative perceptions of stuff? And, you know, for me, when I was growing up, I used to hear this phrase, whenever somebody done something stupid, that's a bit Irish. And I used to think, hang on, I'm Irish. Do you know what I mean? I'm not stupid. That's not.
Yeah.
So this cultural conditioning to kind of look down on yourself, well, there you go. You're distanced from having pride in where you come from.
And we say that a lot, don't we? Like, even say with the mess of the children's hospital, we're like, only in Ireland,
only,
you know,
Ireland.
This kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yet, when good stuff happens, you know, like Cillian Murphy lifting the Oscar, I mean, there are certain traits of Irishness that make us feel very proud. But yeah, we can kind of put it down as foolishness. And I'm really fascinated, particularly about your work, because you sort of traverse the two sides in the connection to the land and the reconnection to the earth and nature, and then a connection to the culture. And that being very much part of who we are and our spiritual well-being and our overall well-being. So talk to me about the proverbs, the sayings that we have and what we can learn from them and your relationship with them. Why did you want to write about them in this way?
The proverbs for me are kind of what the ancestors wished to pass on. So they're the little batons of survival advice. They're these beautiful kind of condensed sound bites that give you, when you look at them and think about them and ponder them, they give you clarity on life experience. So very much like in some of the kind of Buddhist traditions where you might have something like a koan, this kind of conundrum that you ponder. And in the pondering of it, it could be two opposites, you gain enlightenment. It kind of sparks the brain into an epiphany, a realization of something. That's what these kind of proverbs do. It's the, you know, it's the how you tell the child, you know, not to put your hand near the fire and that sort of stuff. These proverbs condense everything. So when our ancestors said, you know, it won't always be raining, they weren't talking about the weather patterns. You know, they were saying if you're in emotional difficulty, if the period of time that you're going through now is distressing or uncomfortable, it will pass. So in the Jewish tradition, you may have this too shall pass. We had it won't always be raining. We took the land. We didn't just take the kind of the sentiment of it because we're so rooted in the land and connected to the land. And so much of our language in terms of the Irish language, you know, is connected into to words that mean something that are connected in with some form of nature. You know, even in terms of the Om language, you know, which is one of the earliest kind of written markation languages, each of the little strats, the stripes that were in there are based on a tree or a bush. So from the very beginning, we were rooted in the land. I mean, Eru, you know, is a tutelary goddess of the land. That's Eru, that's Ireland. That's, you know, this is all part and parcel of who we were. And this thing of like just talking about the weather all the time and it being our famous
obsession,
even though we know it's like, yeah, well, look, it rains all the time, you know? That's that thing of wanting to be connected in with that. And lots of traditions that we used to have, even in terms of like the days of the week, you know, what would you do on a particular day of the week? Like on the Monday, you never give a loan of milk or butter because anything that you do on a Monday continues for the rest of the week. So you want to hold on to your wealth and your luck on a Monday. But on a Tuesday, it's grand to make everybody sandwiches. You know, a Wednesday's a good day to get married. Thursday's not a good day for ploughing the field. Now, whether in actuality that means anything, it's about certainty. It's about giving us certainty. So these proverbs as well was the other form of certainty. All of the little cultural tropes that we do, whether it's a Shanuk or a proverb or whether it's a cultural code, you know, even the fact down to like, say, Wednesday, you know, Wednesday, the Cadine is the day of the forced fast. And that goes back to when the Christian monks came here and started their version of intermittent fasting on a Wednesday, and then also again on a Friday. And Friday, Dayina, is the day of the long fast or the big fast. So we've always wrapped up our culture in our everyday reality, and it comes true in our vocabulary and it comes true in our practices. And I always say we are the stories we tell ourselves. So if we have a little proverb and that's a little like an aspirational quote even stuck on your fridge, that sinks in a lot better than, you know, trying to go off and do a kind of a course on kind of scriptural teaching or hot yoga every Thursday. Or now, they're all brilliant things to go and do, but sometimes what you need to do is you need to recondition the brain. And a lot of the book is about the kind of based on the exercises in it anyway, are based on the cognitive behavioral therapy, positive psychology, mindfulness. It's all these ways to rewired as NLP in their neuro-linguistic programming to get it to sink in, to get the new message, to change ourselves from a negative viewpoint into a positive viewpoint. I mean, I've suffered with depression pretty much most of my life, you know. And the thing with that was I would grow up and I would read the world. I would scan for the negativity and then that would prove my point of view. So if I opened up the curtains in the morning and it was raining outside, I could go, oh God, it's a dreadful day. And then I'm set. I'm set for the day. I'm in that negative mood. If I opened up the curtains in the morning and the sunshine was beaming through, I could go, oh, where's my shorts? Where's my sandals? You know, you can put your negative spin on it. And it's only when you learn to kind of go, oh God, I've been complicit in this, you know? So again, people often find that hard to hear because they go, look, I'm going through depression. I don't know where it came from. It's bolt out of blue. But you can trace it back and you can find it. Now, here's where you got stung by the bee. You know, something happened. There's an inoculation point to let that in at some point and you can get rid of that. Maybe it'll fade. Maybe it's you lost your job or you're having trouble in your relationship and you're feeling sad and you continue to feel sad and you review your sadness every night before you go to bed and then you look for it in the morning when you wake up and you make it an inbuilt thing. You can put that energy into getting up in the morning and feeling better about yourself.
I find the whole area absolutely fascinating. Stay there. We will have to take a break. You are listening to Alive and Kicking here on News Talk with Claire McKenna. And I'm joined in studio by Fionn O'Nuala. And we're talking about his latest book, 52 Proverbs to Fight Depression and Trauma, featuring Irish holistic wisdom.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking, where I'm joined in studio by Fionn O'Nuaillean, and we're talking about his latest book. It's called 52 Proverbs to Fight Depression and Trauma, featuring Irish holistic wisdom. So let's talk about some of the proverbs then, because I think that really puts it into action. Would you be able to pick any favourites, or would it be like picking a favourite child?
In a way, it's like picking a favourite child, because there's so many of them, but there's even more than is in this book, do you know, that you would use on different times.
Yeah.
But like from the book, I mean, there's a couple that I really, really like. And one is that castles are not all built in a day. Right? And the thing from that is, what's interesting about that is it's where the proverb came from. So that proverb came from a point in time when the Anglo-Norman invasion was happening in Ireland. And they would come in, take a territory, build a castle, hold it, move on, take another territory, build a castle. And the kind of the native Irish went, Jesus, that's a good way of achieving success. Not running around crazy all over the place trying to do everything. Do one thing at a time. So there's a life lesson in this. So thereafter, every time we were trying to say to the next generation coming up or to somebody who was kind of struggling with something, you know, do it one at a time. And, you know, for me, coming from the viewpoint of where you're looking at health and you're looking at holistic health, and again, just in terms of with my background in terms of, you know, the social and therapeutic horticulture and the outreach therapy, you know, very often when somebody gets that impetus when they get off alcohol or they get off drugs or they free themselves from their anxiety or their depression, they go gung-ho into everything and they're doing the morning swim in the sea, you know, and they're doing the evening yoga and they're doing the meditation classes and they're really looking to push their life as much forward and as much positive as they possibly can. And the issue is you can get burned out from positivity as much as you can get burned out from negativity. So this thing of one castle at a time, I mean, the secret to it is, you know, you swap one habit for another. So if you go into AA, well, you swap your alcoholism for the program. If you go to NA, you're swapping it for the support of the group and whatever. So, you know, if you want to give up cigarettes, maybe you take up a health kick and that does it. But sometimes some people can be overly enthusiastic about stuff. And 6 months in, they're giving up all the bits and pieces. They fall away. And then what are you left with? You've no castle built to be secure. So pick one thing. It could be mindfulness. It could be the sea swimming, whatever it is. It could be the therapy going each week and having a talk. Build that castle, establish a base, and then from there on you can conquer other territories and do other things instead of trying to do everything at once.
I love that. Now, I found it really hard to pick favourites as well, because every single one sparks a little something and you get to consider it yourself. You sort of discuss it, then you give exercises to kind of help embed it, as you said. So one that I loved was, a lamb becomes a sheep if you carry it for long enough.
Yeah.
And we do love that as Irish people. We do love to strap a burden to our back and then trek along with it. It almost becomes comforting. I used to think the comfort zone could be a positive place, but the comfort zone can actually be a negative place. You can be quite comfortable in that negative space because you don't have to move on.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the kind of the cultural codifying of stuff as well, where we do that, where we wrap ourselves around where, you know, that thing of like, we're good drinkers and, you know, these are all kind of negative tropes that we attach to ourselves as a national identity. And yet when you go back and you look at some of the other stuff, like, you know, a lamb carried far enough becomes a sheep. What genius wisdom is in that? Because we forget that it's okay to lay our burdens down. So if somebody's coming maybe from a Christian context, they might get that, lay your burdens down and free yourself up and, you know, consider the, you know, neither toil nor weep, consider the lilies of the field. You know, this is our way of doing it. We're saying on a very practical basis, coming from that for a very long, long time, the vast majority of people within Ireland had a connection to the land and to agriculture. So what's more readily available than the sheep that you've been herding anyway? So you get, there's a visual thing in that, but there's also a very practical awareness of what that is. So for me, that's about dropping your burdens. That's about letting go. And in the book, I cover practices now and several different proverbs. You're going back and you might be covering how to let go or how not to ruminate, because you want to, over the course of the book, that by the end of the book, you have this set of skills that's going to either disarm the triggers of your depression, or that's going to help you kind of right the ship and be able to sail away from the depression and find yourself in a more positive space. Now, it doesn't mean that depression is gone forever. I still get days where I might feel sad. Like if I turn on the news today, I'm going to be sad. So sometimes I avoid turning on the news, but you don't want to wrap yourself up in a bubble and distance yourself from it either. So sometimes you have to carry the lamb a little bit of the way, but it's how much you get invested in your troubles and your burdens. And for me, one of the points was when I suffered with depression, if I seen a child on the street and the child looked a little bit sad, I would get sad. And I could be sad for 2 days or I could be sad for 2 weeks. Like if a child dropped an ice pop or something like that, my brain would be saying, that's the only treat or ice pop or goodness that child had in its life, and now it's after losing it, and I would be devastated. Now, I don't know that child's backstory. That was my brain coming up with that. That was my negative viewpoint. That was my conditioning. That was my childhood in the thing. And I didn't realise that. So I used to get terribly sad about children all of the time. And when I went and I took counselling, because I thought, I have to deal with this. I can't just be carrying this all my life. I'm a grown man in the street and there's tears coming down my eyes. And there's tears coming down my eyes because there's a child on a swing and its granddad is pushing it on the swing. And the happiness of the child, I'm thinking, that's going to disappear. That's not forever. And then I'm crying. I'm feeling sad for the child. Jeez, I don't even know.
Being your cheap right? Hanging off you.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Do you know? So I said, I have to let this go. I have to put all this down. And in the counselling, I realised that where it came from was that when my grandfather died, at his wake, I was very upset that everybody was kind of laughing and joking and celebrating his life. I didn't get it. I was 10 or something, you know. I didn't really get it. And I felt I didn't have a voice. And when the counsellor kind of said to me, do you think that's what it is? Because we went through all the kind of childhood traumas and all that sort of stuff. And we got to that point. And she said to me, well, that's about voicelessness. And what you're looking at in children is voicelessness and helplessness. And, you know, do you think that's what it is? And when I had the realisation that that's what it was, I went, well, it's only about me. Why do I need to carry this? This is me being selfish. This is me using that child, whether it's happy or sad, for me to get a hit of my depression because it's the emotion I'm most used to. This makes me feel normal. When I'm in this state, I feel like this is who I am. This is my identity. And this is where I got to the point of, like, again, looking at the Irish language, Tá Brón Orm, the sadness is upon me. It's not in you. It's not all of you. It's not who you are. You can take it off you. And that's when I went, okay, how do I get the techniques to take it off me? How do I put this on the ground and let go? And that's when I start doing some of the positive psychology exercises. So there's an exercise in the book about, you know, imagining yourself holding like helium balloons in a park, and each helium balloon has lettering on it. That's what's holding you back. Like it may be regret, you know, sorrow, anxiety, depression, shyness, all of these things that are holding you back in life. And you can feel the tug of the strings pulling. Those balloons don't want to be in your hand. They want to be released up into the sky. And you're looking around and you're seeing friends and family and they're all looking glum, and the strings are pulling and pulling, and you just have the courage to just let them go, and they go up into the, and you let your burdens go with them. You feel free. You look around in this visualization technique and your family and your friends are smiling and they're letting their balloons go. And there's 1,000 balloons in the sky of everybody letting go of their troubles and their traumas. Now, if you do that exercise often enough, what happens is, apart from the fact that it's a kind of a bit of a cathartic release in the moment of it, in the long term of it, you're programming your brain to go, I can let go. You're,
yeah, because I'm sure yourself, you'll still see a kid now and want to go down and start to go down that road, and you go, no, hang on, Fionn.
Yeah.
I don't have to go down there anymore.
I don't have to do that.
Because
yeah,
you did the work. And we will have to wrap, although I could listen to you all day. There's one that I loved: whoever will not accept the advice must accept strife. And that is one of the big messages in the book. Take action, take time, invest in yourself and take the action, because it really does pay off. Fionn, it's always a pleasure to be in your company. You're a very, very special person. It is the most beautiful book. It's really powerful stuff for anybody. If you're going through something or you're not, you'll find something in it. It's called 52 Proverbs to Fight Depression and Trauma, Irish Holistic Wisdom. Fionn O'Nolan, thank you so much for writing it and for coming on today.
Thank you, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to all of my guests, to my producer Aidan McKelvey and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks as ever to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.